In 1997, the University of Minnesota Gophers basketball team was on a stunning postseason run. Just a few short years earlier, the team was in disarray after the arrest of three players and the abrupt departure of the head coach. But under the leadership of new head coach Clem Haskins, the team had rebuilt, finding postseason success in each of his first 3 years.
Minnesota's bench has turned in 23 points to only 10 by the Bruins. They are deeper, of course.
And on March 22, 1997, Gophers fans were stunned when the team beat UCLA 80-72, making it to the Final Four in a shocking upset.
The Golden Gophers to the Final Four in Indianapolis. 80-72.
But scandal and turmoil would overwhelm the team yet again when a young reporter breaks a controversial story. 2 years later, the legacy of Clem Haskins would be up for debate. And this stunning Final Four appearance wiped from the history books. I'm Ian Mont. This week on Campus Files, the Gophers beat.
My name is George Dorman. I'm a longtime investigative reporter for newspapers, including the St. Paul Pioneer Press and then Sports Illustrated. And now I run the investigative unit for The Athletic.
In the summer of 1997, George Dorman moved from Los Angeles to the Twin Cities in Minnesota. He had just taken a job at the St. Paul Pioneer Press, the smaller of the two papers in the area.
And I was put on the University of Minnesota football and basketball beat. That was my job. I was covering the college football team and the college basketball team. That was my full-time gig.
As an out-of-towner, George quickly learned that Minnesota does not mess around when it comes to the University of Minnesota Gophers.
Minnesota hockey and Minnesota basketball are like the two big sports there, and there's just tremendous pride around it. And, you know, they're not a traditional basketball power. They're not Kentucky or Duke or something like that. But locally, they're huge.
The Gophers basketball team suffered a major blow in the late 80s when three players were arrested on rape charges in Madison, Wisconsin. All three were later acquitted, but turmoil over the scandal led to the departure of the head coach. In an effort to rebuild the ailing team, the university brought in Clem Haskins, a former NBA player and successful college coach. Over the next few years, Haskins was quick to find success.
For the first time in 15 years, the Golden Gophers men's basketball team has clinched the Big Ten title, beating the Michigan Wolverines with this free throw by Bobby Jackson. When the score was tied with...
They had made the Final Four the year before I got there, which was just this massive achievement and kind of out of the blue. It was a really big deal. And I remember when I got there, my editor, Emilio Garcia Ruiz, was like, how did Minnesota make the Final Four? And I was like, well, I'll find out. Because there was an assumption on our part that Minnesota doesn't get that good without either getting really, really lucky or some other way.
This success earned Haskins virtual celebrity status, both on and off campus.
The coach at the time, Clem Haskins, had been there for a while, and he kind of had this, like, he owned a farm, and he was kind of this, like, very homespun. He definitely played to the sort of very local pride that exists in the Twin Cities and in Minnesota in general.
As part of wrapping his head around this unfamiliar athletic program, George started by getting familiar with how the team operated.
What I noticed was, like, first of all, the coach was like a deity. Everything ran through him, yes. But he was like, he had his like really small group of trusted people. People were like almost afraid to move into his space. I remember when I first got there, I asked to do a story on a guy who's their star player. And they said, well, you have to go kiss the ring and ask Clem. You have to basically like ask for permission to do a story. And I was like, F that. I'm not doing that. And so there was this sense of like, he controls everything and you need to tiptoe around him and get his permission to even just be a journalist.
Both George and his editor, Emilio, were out-of-towners, having moved from LA. For that reason, they were a bit more suspicious, certainly compared to locals on the Gophers beat. George and Emilio could both look at the team with clear eyes. And what they were seeing was different from other schools they'd covered.
The head coach isn't approving every little story being done about his team at UCLA. He might be aware of it, but it was really odd. By the way, it wasn't that way with the football program. The football program was really media friendly. Practices were open. The coach was really media savvy. So again, it stood out. It's like the football program is operating this way. The hockey program is operating this way, but the basketball program is operating differently. Why is that?
The media operation wasn't the only unique thing about Gophers basketball. The basketball program also had its own independent academic counseling program. Academic counselors are specialized staff intended to help student athletes balance their schoolwork with athletics. And at the time, the school had athletic counselors within athletics to support players across every team. But the basketball team had their own dedicated staff. This unique structure came up in an interview with a former athletic staffer.
He brought up some of the issues that he saw with how academics were very closed off in, you know, basketball had their own guy who did counseling instead of the group counseling, which is what was normal with other sports. But then I just said, like, hey, is there anybody else I should talk to? And he said, yeah, there's this woman, Chang Dangoff, she used to work there. She was really close to the players. She might be somebody good to talk to.
Chan Gangelhoff was a former secretary in the academic counseling office. She had left the team about a year earlier and was now working in a casino in Danbury, Wisconsin. George tracked her down and gave her a call, and it turned out she did have something to share. So George hopped in his car and drove to Danbury.
She's working at a casino. I think she's like a bookkeeper at a casino. Maybe went across the street to like a burger joint or something that was like tied to the casino, and we just sat down and talked. She was confused. She had gotten this letter from the university, and it was a, what's called a letter of dissociation, which is when a program sends a letter to somebody who they said, you broke a rule and we want to say you're not part of our program anymore. It's them telling the NCAA, there's a person, we found something, and we are no longer associating with them. And she was genuinely confused.
This letter of dissociation piqued George's interest. It pointed to some sort of unknown misconduct which Jan was accused of. The trouble was, Jan seemed very hesitant to say any more.
I sensed that Jan kind of sort of knew. She may not know exactly why she got this letter, but she kind of knows the ballpark of why she got this letter. My instincts were like, she kind of knows she did something wrong. She's not willing to tell me right now.
After meeting with Jan for the first time, George reached out to her former supervisor, who had recently retired. Neither were willing to talk at the time, certainly not on the record. But George could tell that there was something there.
Like, I fished around, I asked other people, but it really became like, I need to convince these two women to trust me and tell me what they know.
How did you go about building that relationship and that trust with her?
A, putting in the time, phone calls, visits there, up to see her, getting to know her really well, getting to know what motivated her, what made her tick. I was always a reporter. I was always had a notebook out. She was always very like made clear that like things were on the record or off the record. Sounds strange, but I'd always call her and say, hey, it's George from the Pioneer Press. Even after we'd known each other for years, still saying, it's George from the Pioneer Press. I'm reminding you that I'm a journalist, first and foremost. But I'd go up, I'd smoke a cigarette with her and talk and have a burger with her.
Over the year or so of conversations, small details would slip out here and there, pointing to a larger story which George couldn't quite unlock.
She would say things like, I went on a trip with them to Hawaii. And I remember that I was being like, there is no reason that a secretary from the academic counseling unit who every once in a while tutors the players should be going with the program to Hawaii. No way. And then there were things like she would have birthday parties for them at her house. And I'm like, okay, again, you're way too close to the players if you're a tutor, secretary in the other office, and you're hosting birthday parties for them. Later on, it became things like, you know, she was upset that this letter had come, that letter meant to her that she was, you know, rejected. Like, it was sadness that she couldn't connect with the players, but there would be moments where she'd be like, all that I did for them. You know, at some point it became apparent to me. I was like, she's hiding something.
But outside of this looming secret, George could see how genuine Jan's affection for the players was, even with a year away from the team. It's worth remembering that these athletes are also students first and foremost. And the students that Jan connected with most were in many cases traveling far from home.
She was Native American. And one of the things I learned about her was that she really identified with the players, these Black players who were coming from other places into Minnesota, which, you know, is especially at that time was a, you know, a pretty white state. And what is it like to be a minority in that place? And she really like felt like she was helping them acclimate and feel cared for in a sort of strange place for them.
academic counselors play a very important role. Balancing both athletics and a high-level course load can be very challenging. And with NCAA rules requiring student athletes to maintain decent grades, helping those students find that balance can make or break a team. But the pressure to succeed on the court sometimes outweighs academics. And George was beginning to wonder if that's what Jan's secret was about. The University of Minnesota certainly was not immune to those pressures. In researching for this episode, I found details from a previously confidential NCAA report. According to that report, in the late 70s and early 80s, only 9% of scholarship basketball players on the Gophers graduated. They were the worst performing school by a wide margin. I don't know if Jan or George knew about this history, but it's apparent Jan saw how valuable the opportunity of an education was and had doubts about the school.
If she valued these minorities and their experience here, why wasn't the school educating them? Was the school doing a good job educating them, like talking to her about the shortcomings of the program and the school when it came to these athletes that she cared about?
Then, one day in January of 1999, a switch finally flipped.
When she finally trusted me enough, she called me and she said, you know, I trust you, George. I think you're right. Whatever's going on needs to come out. Ask me whatever you want to ask me. I'll tell you the truth. My first question to her was, did you do homework for the players? I knew already probably what it was. And in that moment, she says, yeah. And I said, how many of them? And she said, pretty much all of them.
More after the break.
August is here, and it has that Sunday of summer kind of feeling. It's a moment to slow down, reset, and prepare for the busy fall season. And a great place to start with that transition is with your wardrobe. There's no better place to do that than Quince. Their clothing is a reminder that you don't need to crowd your closet with endless new pieces. You just need the right high-quality essentials. Quince specializes in effortless staples. From organic cotton t-shirts to Mongolian cashmere sweaters, I personally recommend their washable silk slip dress. Pair it with a blazer for work, then wear it straight out to dinner. Everything Quince makes is priced 50 to 80% less than similar luxury labels because they partner directly with ethical factories, cutting out the middleman markup entirely. And it's not just apparel. Quince brings that same affordability to hotel quality bedding, plush bath towels, and sleek home staples. Upgrade your everyday with Quince. Download the Quince app for app-exclusive offers or go to quince.com/campus. Get free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada and the UK too. That's quince.com/campus.
Hey, it's Jen Hatmaker. Here's what I've learned in midlife. Joy isn't the reward you earn after all the work is done. Joy is the work. That's what this new series on For the Love is all about. The sacred, yes. It's choosing delight, rest, and pleasure on purpose. Because saying yes to yourself, that's the thing that finally lets you fill your table with everybody else. Come find your sacred yes with me. Follow and listen to For the Love wherever you get your podcasts.
Yo, it's Jey Uso from WWE.
And I'm Jimmy Uso.
Chumba Casino and WWE are hyped for the biggest event of the summer, SummerSlam.
I know, I can't wait.
There's nothing better to do while we're waiting
than playing Chumba Casino.
Sign up today and you could win a VIP experience
with Chumba Casino and WWE for SummerSlam.
So what are you waiting for?
Play Chumba Casino and enter for your chance to win.
Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
It's January 1999, and George Dorman, the Minnesota Gophers beat reporter for the St. Paul Pioneer Press, just got a major break. A former tutor and secretary in the academic counseling department had admitted to doing coursework for, she said, pretty much the whole team.
Then I got in my car and I just rushed up there with my tape recorder and we sat at that diner and I asked her the kind of question I was asking her was very different than it changed, right? It was very much like, who did you do work for? How long a period of time? How would it work?
While Jan was now willing to talk, George certainly had his work cut out for him. Was Jan saying that the team had made it to the NCAA Final Four with ineligible players? Because doing schoolwork for student athletes could mean a lot of different things. Typing up a paper a student wrote is one thing, writing it for them is entirely different. And then there was the question of who knew.
Did you get a sense of how this began?
A little bit. I think it starts with you're tutoring them and you know the rules and you know that, like, you sit next to them in the way she described to me. She would sit next to a player and it's like, okay, you want to write this paper about Malcolm X. What do you know about Malcolm X? They would start writing, typing things up, and she would help them formulate sentences and stuff. Normal sort of help. And she said it started out that way. It started out like she was doing it properly, the way that an academic counselor would do.
But as Jan described it, Alonzo Newby, the head counselor for the basketball program, began sending more and more people her way.
Then once she was doing that, and Alonzo Newby understood that he could trust her, he was sending more and more players to her. So she started saying, it's basically like a time issue. I can't take the time. It's going to take so long to get that done. These players are practicing all the time. They're traveling all the time, especially in season.
Meaning effectively, she didn't have the time to do the slow, methodical work of counseling a student directly and helping them to do the work themselves.
So it just became easier for her to write the papers.
But as George learned, it wasn't just a question of what was easiest. There was also explicit and direct pressure coming from above.
It started out with her having the right intentions and doing it the right way. But then it just, the workload that she was being, that was being asked of her, put her in a position where she's, you know, and she would hear about, hey, this player needs this class done or he's going to be ineligible. Like, there was an urgency to it, this idea that, like, if this didn't happen by this day, if he didn't get these papers done, he was going to be ineligible. The team needed him. Poor player. If he was ruled ineligible, he can't play.
And understanding this helped answer the second major question. Who knew?
The NCAA, they have a sort of a standard, which is if you didn't know, should you have known? It is the wrongdoing so pervasive that you should know what's going on. And this constitutes what we call the lack of institutional control. That's the big label that they'll put on a school, that it has lack of institutional control. So I found out talking to Jan's boss eventually that, like, Jan was allowed to tutor athletes for a very short period of time, but she kept tutoring them. I was like, who's setting that up? Well, it became Alonzo Newby saying that. Well, Alonzo Newby is the academic counselor for basketball. Well, who does he report to? Clem Haskins. He had been taken out of the regular channels and given to Clem. So Clem had his own special academic counselor, the only sport at Minnesota that had that. So that was that sort of closed system that they had created. It was Clem, Alonzo, Jan. I didn't have a letter that said, Clem says, good job on that paper. But, you know, we eventually found that Clem paid for her trip to Hawaii, which, again, why would he pay for a secretary in a different department of the athletic department to go to Hawaii with the team, kind of thing. But I didn't care too much about, like, who knew, because when I realized how widespread it was, I was like, well, them not knowing is just as bad as them knowing in some ways.
George had found himself with a major story about academic misconduct at a recently ascendant Minnesota Gophers basketball team. But now he had the tricky job of proving it, and proving it in a way that the paper would publish. Through this whole process, he had been working with his editor, Emilio, who he had worked with in LA before. Both were out-of-towners.
There were a lot of people who worked at the newspaper who graduated from the University of Minnesota, who had worked at the paper a long time. The Twin Cities is a big community, but it's also a small town vibe, a lot to it. So there was a lot of concern about, like, would somebody tip off somebody at the university? Maybe not intentionally, but they might just be like, in passing, like, hey, I hear George is working on some big story about the Gophers. Like, that would be enough to raise alarms and complicate my reporting. There was genuine concern that, like, we had reporters in the newsroom who might tip off the university. Was it valid? I can't say, but I was really going to safe than sorry kind of situations.
So George and Emilio made the tricky decision not to tip off the rest of the team or the editor-in-chief, at least until they could prove it. Finally, in March, George went to Wisconsin to meet with Jan one more time. This time, she tells him she can prove it and shows him her computer, which was full of papers she had written for student athletes.
Once we had the papers, once we had all of her papers, we could see what who she had written for, because their names were on the papers.
George copied about 450 files from Jan's computer. He went home and printed them and brought them to his editor's house. The two of them spent the next few days sifting through everything. They found cases where two separate players had turned in the exact same paper in two separate years. They also found cases where parts of an essay was repeated in multiple papers. Each case included a cover page with the name of the athlete, the course, and the date it was submitted.
There was like a paper, one turned in about the menstrual cycle, that I was like, where's this coming from? And, you know, misspellings in the same papers a year apart for two different players, or same paragraphs but with the same error.
By this point, it was the first couple of days of March 1999. And what George didn't realize, because he was so focused on reporting this story, was that the Gophers were just days away from playing a major NCAA tournament. By this point, they had keyed in the rest of the staff to this story. And the discovery of the papers made reporting it quickly very urgent. There was always the risk of a leak or that another paper would beat them to the punch.
Then it became, I need some players to tell me this is true. And so I picked three players who had transferred out. Presumably they leave the school. They're not on good terms. So I went and saw those three players. And one right away was like, yep, she did all my homework there. One was like coming hemming and hawing. And I remember I said like, so is Jan lying? She's lying then. She's a liar. And I remember he was like, because he cared about her. She'd done a lot for him. And he was like, no, she wouldn't lie. No. What she's saying is the truth. And then another one was like, hey, listen, I know she did work for other players, but she didn't do anything for me except for this one little thing. But he was just being honest. So once I had that, I was like, okay, we have a story.
But now the first tournament was only a couple days away. The paper wanted to get it out as quickly as possible rather than sitting on a major story as the team is playing with possibly ineligible players.
We were going to go so fast. It was like, we need to write this. I was writing drafts of it and things like that. So we're writing it. We're prepping this day when we're going to go out and try to reach all these people. There were players. There was two players who were on the Timberwolves at the time, who were University of Minnesota graduates, that we were going to ask about this.
You were going to do it all in one day?
That was the plan.
In the end, the hardest comment to get was from the school itself, particularly head coach Clem Haskins.
They just head and sanded us. Like, they just literally just pretended like we weren't calling them. And I'm calling guys who I've dealt with daily. I'm calling their athletic director or their associate AD for sports media. And I'm saying to them, hey, I got a really big story about academic fraud I need to talk to you about. And they're like, oh, okay, we'll get back to you. Nothing. And so we actually were planning on running the story one day before we actually did. But then we held it because we couldn't get a response from the university.
Finally, the higher ed reporter for the paper contacted the president's office directly. The next day, they finally got a comment from Clem.
I think it was Clem. It was like, you know what kind of man I am. You know what I stand for. It was one of those like kind of comments. And it wasn't a denial. It wasn't saying I didn't know about this or this is news to me or this would never happen. It was, you know what kind of man I am. You know what kind of person, what I stand for. This is a guy who is leaning on exactly what we've talked about, which is that he's leaning on this reputation, this perception that he's created amongst the local media, that they trust that Clem does it the right way. Clem's about integrity. So again, it took two guys, myself and my editor from the outside, to come in and just be like, hey, what's going on here?
Finally, after months of work and years of relationship building, the story was finally ready to be published in the St. Paul Pioneer Press.
You know, I remember the day before we ran, I walked across the newsroom and I looked at a big screen where the front page of the newspaper was being laid out. And it's just this like big banner headline. And I go, oh, we're doing that? Like, meaning like, we're going to go that big with it? And they were like, yeah, what are you talking about? So I even have an idea of like how big they were going to play it or how big it was going to be. At the LA Times, when we ran the UCLA stories, like the editor there used to say like bottom right. Meaning like bottom right of the front page. This was like the whole front page of, like that's bottom right of the sports section. This was front page of the whole newspaper, the front page of the paper, banner headline, monster headline.
In the end, the piece was set to publish on the front page on the morning of March 10th, 1999. And the Gophers were already in Seattle, preparing for their first tournament game, set for March 11th.
That time of year, March Madness, girls and boys state tourney basketball on its way.
And college hoops, of course, the Gopher men's b-ball team takes on Gonzaga tomorrow.
Yeah, but a story which surfaced today has moved in like a storm, a possible cheating scandal. It may rain all over the Gophers' tourney hopes.
It's the morning of March 10th, 1999. And Georgia's story on the Gophers basketball cheating scandal is finally breaking.
Yeah, I remember I got like a phone call like 5 a.m. Some radio guy called me. Can we get you on the air right now? And I'm like, what? What time? I don't even know what's going on here. I was up till whatever.
The St. Paul Pioneer Press is hitting the doorsteps of subscribers with a bold-faced headline alleging academic fraud in the basketball team, set to play a tournament game just that following day.
And I went into the office and people were just lambasting us for the timing of it.
The response from the public was immediate outrage, but it wasn't directed at the team. It was directed at George and the Pioneer Press.
I remember talking to someone, like our reader advocate, and she was like, we have X number of subscription cancellations. And I was like, what? Why? If it's true, don't they want to know about it? Don't they want to know that the team they're watching cheated?
Following George's reporting, the team suspended the four active players named in the piece, two of whom were starters. All teams have to play by the same rules, and all athletes have to meet certain academic standards. If the Gophers had played with players who had cheated, then in effect, the team was cheating. With these four players benched, the Gophers went on to lose the March 11th game. The nuances of the timing and competitive implications didn't matter for public reaction.
The governor of Minnesota at the time was Jesse Ventura, the former wrestler, and he compared us to the National Enquirer and made all these big blustery statements, which is pretty much all he did in his entire time as governor, was make blustery statements.
It just showed me another example of Pioneer Press sensational journalism, of their timing. I think it's despicable, and they felt the need to release this story the day before the NCAA tournament. It couldn't have waited until after. It's just another example.
George, for his part, was caught off guard by the backlash. He knew fans wouldn't be happy to read the story, but he also knew it was better to get the story out before the tournament than after.
If they had played that game and we'd written it the day after they played that game, if they'd won, they'd have been forced to forfeit the game, and it'd have been much more complicated. And I know like the editors were talking about it. We're just going to run it when it's ready. And people don't believe that. The criticism we got for it was like, that's BS. You timed it perfectly to get maximum impact on my children. I swear, we just ran it. We finally got it. Like, it took me so long to get it. We finally got it.
How did the university and the team respond to this going out into the public?
There was criticism of the paper timing, and how muted the response was also telling. None of the players that we accused were made available for comment. That's not surprising.
George continued to report on the story for months. As is typical, one article draws out sources and information for the next.
We kept reporting, obviously. We showed that Clem had written a check to Senator Hawaii. We had some other things. We had another counselor come forward and say, yep, I wrote papers for them too. There was just more and more stories. We had grade changing and how they were changing grades after the fact. So it was just like this drip, drip, drip of just showing you how messed up the basketball program was. And then once that started happening, you just start seeing people getting fired.
When you're continuing to report on this and the full scope of the story, including the institutional knowledge, becomes more clear to the public, do you feel the public perception change at all, or do they still stay pretty hostile to you guys?
It shifted a little bit, not for everybody, but it shifted a little bit to more like, yeah, it's probably true, but they still shouldn't have run it when they did. Did they have to ruin my experience as a fan watching my basketball team?
For his reporting, George won a Pulitzer Prize, the highest honor in journalism. In journalism schools across the country, one of the lessons taken from this story is of the perils of getting too enamored with a source, like much of the local media seemed to have with Clem Haskins.
They would write about him in these sort of like fawning ways and like write anecdotes about him and his farm, that you were like, just like in their little notes columns, and you were just like, man, you guys are just like drinking the Kool-Aid here. It's not like you say, oh, he was treated with kid gloves. He was never criticized, it felt like. He was never scrutinized. And he just sort of had this like, he had worked the local media to a degree that there were sort of like unwritten approaches that they took with him and his program.
Eventually, Clem Haskins was fired after an investigation. He first denied, but later admitted to paying Jan at least $3,000 to write papers for students, proving both direct knowledge and encouragement. He also directed many players to lie to investigators. Haskins was barred from coaching in the NCAA for 7 years. The program faced both self-imposed and NCAA sanctions for years afterwards, including the forfeiture of their 1997 Final Four placement. And what's so easily lost beneath debates over details and sanctions is the direct impact on student athletes. It's something George has continued to think about even nearly 30 years after reporting this piece.
The concept of the student athlete was sort of a farce because they're spending so much time playing their sport. They leave school early. They take lighter course loads. The notion that these athletes are just like normal students was something that the NCAA back then, especially still today, is constantly pitching this idea like, this is the student athlete. This is the model. This is wonderful. This is the best of both worlds. And if you're either in it, you know that's all nonsense. So these scandals, when they hit, especially an academic scandal like this, it just shatters that notion. Hey, here's your Final Four team from a couple years ago.
This, from George's assessment, is what made Jan finally choose to speak up. She cared about these students and the opportunity that this education afforded them.
She came to see that the university had betrayed these athletes. Like, that was the biggest driver. I helped her see that what she was doing, what the university was encouraging her to do, the university was endorsing, was shortchanging these athletes. Their promise to the athletes was that they would educate them. And they were, instead of doing the hard work of doing that, which might mean, you know, ruling them ineligible for a little while till they got their grades better, or it might mean giving them extra real tutoring and monitoring their work closely. Instead of doing that work, this was a shortcut the university was taking that was ultimately screwing those athletes because they were getting no degree in most cases or sham degree because they weren't being educated.
After leaving the St. Paul Pioneer Press, George then spent 15 years at Sports Illustrated and is now the senior managing editor at The Athletic, where he manages a team of reporters. If you've got a story idea, we would love to hear about it. Send us an email at campusfilespod@gmail.com. And if you're loving this podcast, be sure to click follow on your favorite podcast app so you never miss an episode. While you're there, leave us a review and a 5-star rating. Campus Files is an Odyssey original podcast hosted by Margot Gray and Ian Mont. Our executive producers are Leah Reese-Dennis and Lloyd Lockridge. Campus Files is produced by Ian Mont and Margot Gray. Sound design and engineering by Andy Jaskowitz and Zach Clark. Legal support by Laura Berman and Melissa Jean. Original music by Davey Sumner. Special thanks to Maura Curran, Josephina Francis, Hilary Schuff, Eric Donnelly, Kate Hutchison-Rose, Sean Cherry, Kurt Courtney, and Lauren Vieira.